You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Christina Song.
I'm Arman Rana.
And I'm Ben Nelson.
And I'm Bryn Schaefer. It's Thursday, July 4th at 5.03 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hankaminam-speaking Musqueam people. After last week's contested redevelopment rejection at 4575 Granville Street, CITR's Alex DeBoer speaks with COPE City Councillor Jean Swanson. Councillor Swanson says her major concern with supporting this particular redevelopment is its unaffordability. In response, some critics pushed on Swanson and other councillors, pointing out that the property owner now plans to build a mansion on the property instead.
After that interview, we hear that what Vancouverites think of a new South Granville three-section crosswalk designed by Musqueam artist Robin Sparrow. Reporters Christina Song and Adeline Pung hung out between West 70th Avenue and West 68th Avenue yesterday afternoon to get comment from pedestrians.
But first, we have some headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland.
In the Vancouver Sun, Dan Fumano reported that Councillor Colleen Hardwick is feeling out of step with the rest of council. Last Wednesday, Hardwick cast the only vote in opposition to a new city report on reconciliation. Hardwick has voiced concerns over the city following faulty prevailing narratives when it comes to the city's overall reconciliation strategy, as well as the city's earthquake preparedness. Fumana reports that Hardwick's overarching concern is what she calls scope creep, which means she's concerned the city is stepping in and spending taxpayer money in areas traditionally overseen by the provincial or federal governments.
In sports news, the Vancouver Canucks have added a local British Columbian defenseman to their roster this week. Jordy Benn, who originally did not make the Canucks or their minor league affiliate after going undrafted as a young teenager, has been signed to a two-year $4 million contract. After spending years in the second and third tier leagues of pro hockey, he got his NHL debut with Dallas in the 2013-2014 season. In addition to playing for Dallas, he has also played for Montreal. Now a veteran defenseman, in an interview with Czech News, the now 31-year-old Jordy describes being signed with the team that originally cut him as everything coming full circle. Welcome home, Jordy.
And it's not only hockey players that run the risk of injury on the job. Stunt performers are coming forward about a culture of not reporting injuries that take place on the job. In an interview with CBC, Laurie Stewart, a former X-Men stunt performer and current safety performer advocate, spoke about her experience not getting checked out at hospital after landing on concrete on her head and neck. Just 2 years ago, Joyce Harris, a 40-year-old stunt performer, died on the set of Deadpool 2 in Vancouver. A 2012 survey found that most performers had at least one job-related concussion, but seldom reported the incident for fear of losing their job.
All right, those are your headlines for the week. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're now going to turn to an interview done last Friday with COPE City Director Jean Swanson. In this interview, reporter Alex DeBoer poses the question, are there only two choices in Vancouver, expensive rental or mansions and condos?
So after a 7-4 council vote on June 25th, a redevelopment application at 4575 Granville Street was rejected. The application was made under one of the city's rental incentive programs and proposed to build two townhouses on a large lot, creating 21 rental units. Councillors who voted against the redevelopment had a number of reasons for doing so, but the most pressing was affordability. These 21 rental units would have been very expensive, a three-bedroom unit renting for $3,700 a month. For this reason, Councillor Swanson voted against the application. In the wake of this vote, the property owners have said they now plan to build a mansion on the property instead. Let's take a listen to what Councillor Swanson has to say about her vote, which may have contributed to the construction of a mansion on the property. And just a minor correction moving forward, the property address is referred to in this interview as 4745, but its actual number is 4575 Granville Street. Okay, let's take a listen.
So we're continuing with the rezoning of 4575 Granville Street. On June 20th, council considered hearing from speakers regarding a rezoning proposal for 4575 Granville Street and closed the receipt of public comments. Council then recessed at a public hearing.
On Tuesday, June 25th, City Council voted on a rezoning application at 4547 Granville Street. This application was for a townhouse development with 21 market rental units. The project was voted down 7-4. Councillors voting against were all three of the Greens, the MPAs Colleen Hardwick, Rebecca Bly, and Sarah Kirby-Young, as well as COPE's Jean Swanson. On June 27th, the Vancouver Courier published an interview with a family member of the property owner at 4547 Granville Street, Gravir Pabla. Gravir told the Courier that since his family's rezoning application failed, they now plan to build a large home on their lot, instead of 21 rental units. The Pablas applied for this redevelopment under one of the city's rental incentive programs. Gravir says they followed all the rules and that this kind of rejection will discourage other rental developments from being built in Vancouver. There are a lot of angles to this particular story. The seven councillors who voted against this redevelopment did so for a variety of reasons. There were concerns that the new development would disrupt a hospice right across from the property, and that there hadn't been enough community consultation, but the largest issue was affordability. Although the development was set to build 21 rental units, those units would be rented for just 20% less than market value. So for example, a three-bedroom would cost $3,700 a month. Despite the various critiques councillors had of this development, it really comes down to whether you believe an increased rental stock, even if it's expensive, is a viable way to improve the rental crisis in Vancouver, versus if you believe expensive rental only gentrifies and drives up rental prices despite adding supply. I reached Councillor Jean Swanson to ask if she'd still be willing to trade in 21 units of albeit expensive rental for what is now likely to become one mansion. Hi, Councillor Swanson. This is Alex DeBoer calling.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me today. I know you've had a super busy week. Lots of council. Well, thanks. So I just wanted to talk to you about the vote on the redevelopment application at 4547 Granville Street. Because did you see the Vancouver Courier article that came out yesterday, which was an interview with the property owner?
Oh, I didn't see that one. Is that the one where he says he wants to build a house there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was just wondering, because the application was to build two townhouses, which would have produced 21 market rental townhouses. And now the owner is saying, we don't know what he'll do for sure, but he's saying he wants to build a large house now. I'm just wondering what your reaction is to that.
Well, what I was hoping, because he said that he was open to all options when asked if he would pay more community amenity contributions, I was hoping that he would, without a little pressure, which I hoped a no vote would be, that he'd go back and come back with another proposal that would be more affordable.
Right. Yeah, so you were hoping it would sort of push him to change his application and make it more affordable.
Yeah,
but as that didn't happen, do you regret voting against the application?
Well, it was a hard decision. It was almost a 6-1 way and half a dozen the other type of decision, and I eventually landed where I always land on affordability. I mean, the good part of the proposal was A, no one was being demo evicted, and B, it's densifying a single family neighborhood. But then the bad part was it's densifying it with housing that's really quite expensive, $3,700 for a 3-bedroom apartment. Mm-hmm. And I've seen the city stats that there's a 8.7 vacancy rate in apartments that are renting for over $3,700.
Right.
So, to me, it was, I don't know, it was just me trying to, I mean, mean the way I thought of it, which is different than the way lots of other people thought of it. I was trying to, hoping that it would, by saying no, we could make it more affordable.
Right. The way this Vancouver Courier article, which is, it's basically, I guess you have seen it, it's an interview format. And the author, I believe her name's pronounced Niamh O'Connor. So when she was talking to the property owner, basically, you know, she asked him about some of the criticisms that counselors brought up. And sort of my takeaway from the article or interview was that, you know, basically this was a choice between the greater or lesser of two evils. Do you think that's a fair assessment of this vote on rezoning this property? Like that there were only these two outcomes. It was either townhouses that were quite expensive or a mansion is built. Is that the choice here in Vancouver when we want to build rental?
Well, as I told some people in interviews after the vote, I would love it if we had social housing on that site.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love it if we had modular housing on that site. I don't know. I think those should be options.
Mm-hmm.
I think it should be, we should have more options like that. We should have more options like that in wealthy areas like that one.
But as it stands, the city, like the system we have at City Hall, where we have programs available to developers to create purpose-built rental, which we obviously need in this housing crisis. And those programs are things like Rental 100 and this program that the applicant at 4547 Granville Street applied under, which is the city's Affordable Housing Choices and Interim Rezoning Policy. So those are currently like the programs we have available to encourage developers to build purpose-built rental. So how can we get other options so that there would be options to encourage developers?
Oh, my God. How can we get other options? You can make motions and have them defeated.
Yeah.
You can make motions and have them ruled out of order.
Yeah.
You can make motions and have them go back for a staff report that happens months and months and months down the line. Yeah, that's what you can just try to do. And I've been trying to do it. I had one, I don't know, a few weeks ago where I was just trying to have... See, the city now has the option for rental-only zoning.
Mm-hmm.
So if that site were zoned for rental only, then the owner wouldn't have the option of putting in something that can be sold, like a house, or
Right.
And so that got defeated on a fancy procedural thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm trying to figure out how to bring it back, but it's complicated because I'm afraid it'll be ruled out of order again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and we have some motions that have passed that hopefully we'll be getting reports back maybe at the end of July and to relook at the Rental 100 program.
Yeah,
I've tried amending rezonings that came to us just to add vacancy control to houses or to apartments in the Rental 100 program, like to make it so one of the problems with the Rental 100 program is that the rents are high to start with, and then as soon as the first tenant leaves, the landlord can raise them as high as the rents, as high as the market will bear. So I just tried to put a lid on that so that the landlord could only raise rents as the annual allowable limit, not mm-hmm. as much as you want when a tenant leaves. And those all got defeated. So,
yeah,
there's things that you can do. There's things that a city government could do, but this city hasn't done them yet.
Right.
And I'm pushing it in that direction, and there may be something happening in a month or two or more, or there may not. We'll see if we can get the votes for it.
Right. So right now your strategy, because the status quo leaves basically no options within our, you know, neoliberal economy that's reliant on developers to build housing, there are really no options where through the market they're going to build affordable housing.
And the other thing with which I always say is we have to get off that horse that we rely on the private market to build housing.
Right.
Because I've actually heard developers say they won't build housing for people who earn under $70,000.
Right.
And the average renter makes about $50,000. And renters in the most need make a lot less than that. Mm-hmm. So we have to get a source of revenue from the feds or the province, or from the province giving the city the ability to use progressive taxation to do it ourselves. We mm-hmm. have to get a source of money to build non-market housing. That is the ultimate solution.
Right. And I understand that. But then, so the way to get to that solution is, like you said, if I'm understanding you, to put forward motions that maybe ask for funding from provincial and federal governments, and to try to implement, to try to add amendments to rezonings like vacancy control and stuff. Is that sort of like all you can do as a counselor is just
If we had a different council, if we were New West, mm-hmm. we could start implementing the rental only zoning. But we don't have the votes for, I don't have the votes for that now in Vancouver. We could implement a business license way of preventing rent evictions like New West has. But I don't have the votes for that now.
Yeah.
I've tried.
So the majority of council is essentially accepts the status quo as we have to rely on the market, and there's no way around that. There's nothing we can do.
I think the majority of council would like to get more housing from other levels of government. I don't think there's support from the majority of council for vacancy control. And I think part of our job as politicians is to try and change that so that, you know, vacancy control and getting more money from other levels of government, or getting that power for the city to have a progressive tax like a mansion tax, becomes part of public dialogue and becomes accepted, like single-payer Medicare mm-hmm. is accepted.
Right. And do you think our provincial government or our current federal government will have in the future an interest in putting more money into housing? Because obviously the provincial government gave a bunch for temporary modular housing this year, but in the past
year they put 2,000 units in for mm-hmm. the whole province, and Vancouver got 600 of them. This year they put 200 units in for the whole province.
Yeah, less. Yeah.
And there's 7,000 counted homeless people in the province, over 7,000, and that's an undercount. So it's not nearly enough. And the feds are just, they're so awful. They say that they have a national housing strategy, and they talk about having a national housing strategy, and then when you take it apart, most of the money is loans. Half of the money is counting provincial matching contributions. And what have we got from it? Virtually nothing over the last few years in Vancouver, virtually nothing, even though they've announced $1.2 billion for Toronto. And so now would be a nice time to try and pressure them to get a little bit more. Anyway,
right.
Yeah, it's an uphill road, that's for sure.
Right. So, sorry,
with housing being so expensive, I think people are going to see that we need more investment in it, more, and I'm hoping it can become like Medicare, and mm-hmm. people will see the advantage of having lots of non-profit housing. Non-profit housing can be really nice to live in. I live in mm-hmm. a co-op, and it is really nice.
Yeah. Well, and so with things as they are, you're fighting to get more funding from different levels of government for housing. You're fighting for things like vacancy control, different rent controls to make life more livable for renters. But right now, while we don't...
Rental-only zoning.
Right, rental-only zoning. But as
and
things...
changing the city's rental programs, which
right.
we're waiting for reports back from staff on that.
Right, on Rental 100, for example. But right now, while we're waiting for that, if there's another project that comes up for rezoning like this one, where there's the option to build purpose-built rental, but it's not affordable, is it still better, do you think, to vote against it or for it?
Well, I'm going to get to make that decision, I think, fairly soon on these MERP programs,
mm-hmm.
Moderate Income Rental Housing Pilot Project. Okay, there's two of them coming for East Hastings, right next to Boundary Road, 14 stories, and they want to put 20% for people who are earning between $30,000 and $80,000. Now, I'm supposed to keep an open mind. Legally, I have to keep an open mind on these. And so I have to say that I have an open mind mm-hmm. on it. I can't say how I'm going to vote. But I will say that one of my concerns is that if you put a building like this in a neighborhood that is essentially a low-income mm-hmm. neighborhood, that the 80% of units that aren't low-income are going to gentrify the rest of the neighborhood, not those two buildings, but the rest of the neighborhood, and push up property values, taxes, and rents. So I think that's a concern.
But then if you vote against it, what is the alternative? Nothing gets built, or?
One thing that I think could be done, well, I had a meeting with a developer, and he was wanting to put in one of these MERP buildings, and I said, would you go to 30%?
Yeah.
And he said, yeah. And then the conversation continued, and he backtracked a little bit, you know, maybe if you give me 5 extra stories.
Right.
But I think they can be pushed. I think if we say, you know, I think they can be pushed.
Right. So you think if council keeps rejecting purpose-built rental that is under our various incentive programs, which largely produces near-market cost rental, at least the majority of it, that if we keep rejecting them, it'll... Because some people are saying that will cause developers to just stop developing here. But you think maybe instead it'll...
developers always say that, right? This has been all the neoliberal tried-and-true tactic. I've heard of it I'm 76, I've heard of it for the last 50 years, ever since I was old enough to be conscious of it.
Right.
If you don't do what we like, we'll take our money and go. But I remember back in old days when Bruce Erickson and Dero were trying to get sprinklers in the SRO hotels because people were dying right, left, and center in fires. Mm. And the SRO owner said, oh, we can't possibly put sprinklers in. It's too expensive. We'll have to close. But the city cracked down and made them put in sprinklers. And as a result, the people lived and the hotels didn't close. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, sometimes when you push, you can get that kind of outcome. And, you know, Tommy Douglas said, you know, we want socialized medicine. We want people to be able to go to the doctor if they don't have a lot of money. And the doctors went on strike.
Yeah.
And he pushed. And now the doctors are working and we have medicine where you don't have to pay and go to the hospital for free. So sometimes it's worth pushing.
Right. And I guess the only thing is that if the choice is between market rental or market rate housing, rental housing, and condos or a mansion, do you think we can still push developers so that they build rental? Because if it was like you either build this rental under these conditions or nothing, then I could see them doing that. But if it's like, oh, instead we'll just build condos.
Well, that's when a rental-only zoning comes in.
Right.
Why don't we have rental-only zoning in the whole... I can remember when there was no such thing as condos. You owned your house or you rented an apartment.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot.
Anyway, those are the directions that I'm trying to push, right? More government money, mm-hmm. more city more regulations that require rental, and more little nips and little things to try and make the rental that does get built more affordable. And all the time pushing for vacancy control, because I think that'll help a lot.
Yeah.
One of the things vacancy control will do is, so a lot of apartment buildings are being sold now on the condition. I mean, the ad actually says, if you get rid of your, in a subtler way, if you get rid of your tenants, you can raise the rents. The ad says, mm-hmm. says that. And so because the banks know that vacancy control doesn't exist and owners can do this, they'll give new buyers a higher mortgage, and the price of property of the apartment buildings is higher because we don't have vacancy control, and if we did have it, so if it were lower, then they could be bought cheaper and they could rent cheaper. So and maybe even people who live in them could buy them and turn them into co-ops and things like that. So there's lots of things that could be done, and in Berlin. They just got a 5-year rent freeze, and they got more strict vacancy control in New York City. So people are doing things, and I think we need to push in those directions.
Yeah, it just seems maybe like because things are so globalized now. Like, for example, we had vacancy control, right, in the 70s. Under the Socreds, but now we have an NDP government and they won't even consider it. So, like, it seems like everything has moved a little bit to the right in terms of housing, at least. And
yeah, and it used to be that CMHC, the federal government's housing finance arm, funded social housing, and now they guarantee mortgages.
Yeah.
So, yeah, mostly. They do other things too, but they've really shifted in that direction, and we have to get everything shifted back.
So maybe like are you I'm just picking up on maybe you're suggesting there needs to be more organizing, and this has to come from kind of the people.
Definitely we need we just had a housing emergency summit last weekend. Christine Boyle and Pete Fry and I were there, and there was up to 200 people there, I think. We had speakers from the Downtown East Side and from Seattle, and we actually had a speaker from Berlin by Skype or something. Yeah. And, yeah, it was pretty energizing, people wanting to get together and fight for what we need. There was talk about declaring a housing emergency in Vancouver. So I'm doing some research on that to see what we can, if we did that, what powers would it give us and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I actually I went to the summit and recorded some of it. There was also that folk song called The City We Need.
Good old Pete.
Yeah. All right, well, I think that's all the questions I have, Jean. I really appreciate you taking time after, like, a very long week to chat with me.
And I appreciate your reading this and the
But if we can get this done right today, in days to come, it might turn into the city we need.
You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We just had some local headlines and an interview with Councillor Jean Swanson over a redevelopment vote on 4575 Granville Street. We have more local news coming up, including a story about what Vancouverites think of a new artfully designed crosswalk in Marpole. We'll be right back after this short break.
There is a penguin sliding on an iceberg, and then the fiery ice cracks, and the penguin sees Donald Trump and feels numb and dies. Donald Trump hops into a balloon and floats away. A child sees him and says, "Look, something ugly is in a balloon." The end.
Are you a kid with a story to tell?
Want to learn how to make great radio?
Then sign up for CITR's
Kids Radio Camp!
On-air training,
games,
field trips,
and more! Happening this summer from July 15 to 19.
Kids aged 11 to 14 are welcome.
To register, go to CITR.ca.
Thursday, July 18th at Lanalouse, Montreal's Orchestre Criminal come to Vancouver for an evening of klezmer punk, turbo folk, and ancient gangster tunes from around the world. That's Thursday, July 18th at Lanalouse, Montreal's Orchestre Criminal with local favorites, Balkan Schmalkin. Tickets are $12 in advance at brownpapertickets.com, $15 at the door. Co-presentation of Discorder Magazine and CITR 101.9 FM.
Did you know UBC students get 20% off organic, farm-fresh produce from the UBC farm? Come by the farm and eat local. Really, really local. Supported by British Columbia's Buy BC program.
And we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Today we've gone over some local headlines and also heard an interview with Councillor Jean Swanson on the challenge of building affordable rentals in Vancouver. Next, we're going to turn our attention to public art in Vancouver. On June 21st, National Indigenous Peoples Day, a colorful pedestrian crossing was added to Granville Street between West 70th and West 68th Avenue. It was created by a Musqueam artist named Robin Sparrow.
Right. So myself, Christina Song, and Adeline Ping went out to Marpole yesterday afternoon to ask folks walking by what they thought of the new crosswalk design. We got quite an array of answers, and I just want to mention that we did reach out to the artist, Robin Sparrow, but she was not available, or we didn't hear back from her before this broadcast. So let's take a listen. So we're here between 68th and 70th Avenue on Granville Street, and we're looking at the public art created by Robin Sparrow, who is an Aboriginal artist and who is part of the Coast Salish weaving tradition. She was commissioned by the City of Vancouver to create this public art, which is actually on the crosswalk in the street, and it is really beautiful. Actually, it has these zigzag patterns in yellow and
white, black, Sonoma sand, and brick red, and you can see there's a unique texture to it.
Yeah, there's like a relief running through it that outlines all the colors, and it just looks like a wood carving, but on a street, which is pretty cool.
And the interesting thing is that it's also three sections. So there's two parallel sections, vertical sections, running in front of us. And then on the other side of the street, there's a horizontal section that bridges two streets.
It's actually a very major thoroughfare, and there are a lot of cars. So in terms of visibility, I think it's pretty good. The only thing is that it's making our recording a little hard.
Yeah, so they chose this because, as Christina mentioned, this is an active retail area, and also because it's near to an ancient Musqueam village, which is pretty symbolic.
Yes, and there is quite a bit of foot traffic despite it being in the middle of the afternoon on a weekday. So we're going to try and flag down one of these pedestrians and see if they can answer some questions about how they feel about the public art installation. Let's talk to those people. They look like they're crossing the street. What is your name?
Hi, my name's Courtney Rempel.
Hi. I was wondering, you just crossed the crosswalk here where they have a public art installation. Mm-hmm. I was wondering what you were thinking when you were crossing the street.
Yeah, actually, I did see them when they were painting it, and I did learn that it's for the Musqueam Nation, First Nations people. And I think it's really cool to have something like that in our neighborhood that pays tribute to those people. So I think it's lovely. I like it.
Do you think that this will have an impact on your community in any way?
I think so, in a way. You know, it just raises awareness, which is always a good thing. So I think it should have a positive community outreach, and it's just a good thing to have in Marple. It's nice to see.
What do you think about public art in general?
Actually, it's something I look for even when I go to new cities. I always enjoy seeing the public art displays. It's something that you shouldn't have private. It should be something in the public. So I think it's good.
Hi.
Hi.
Could you tell us your name?
Christina.
Hi, Christina. I was wondering, have you seen this crosswalk before or noticed it?
No, I haven't been here I think last week. So I didn't notice it's there.
What do you think about it?
Oh, very attractive. I like the color. Yeah.
Have you heard about what it's about?
Not that I know of.
This is actually an installation by a Musqueam artist to kind of memorialize the ancient Musqueam village that used to be on this land. So it's supposed to represent the history behind this area.
Okay. For Native?
Yes.
Oh, I see. That's interesting. Yeah. I heard about the Native in this area, but yeah, I never thought about that would be...
Have you lived in this neighborhood very long?
In this area? About 3 years.
And do you think that it kind of like adds to the character of the place, or what do you think it does to the community when there's an art installation like this?
I love to see that, yeah, because we live in a multicultural society, a country, so we love to see all other countries or background, you know, into the community.
Okay, thank you so much for your time.
No problem.
All right, could you tell us your name?
My name is Jerome.
Hi, Jerome. Do you live in this area?
Yes, I do. I do.
Have you noticed that the crosswalk has changed in the past few weeks?
Yes, I noticed that. Yeah, there's some colors on the ground, yeah?
What do you think about it?
Well, I think it kind of looks like my ancestors. It looks like the German flag. It's the three, red, the black, and yellow, so that's kind of funny.
Oh, interesting.
That's about it.
Do you have any idea what it's supposed to represent?
No. Other than that, I thought, no.
It's actually done by an Aboriginal artist, and it's supposed to commemorate the ancient Musqueam village that this area is built upon.
Oh.
I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
Well, actually, I'm very fond of Aboriginal culture, First Nation, rather. So now that I know that, it makes it a different, different thing altogether, yeah.
Right. What do you think about public art installations like this?
Well, I think it's important that we show the Aboriginal culture and different things like that. And I think we do a great job in Canada anyways, because I travel throughout Canada. I think there's a lot to be shown. Yeah.
What do you think it does to the community when we have art installations like this?
Well, the thing is that I don't know that it's very clear what it's about. So unfortunately, if you hadn't asked me and told me, I would have never known. I thought this was these reminded me of the colors of the German flag. So really, it's completely out of there. So really, there's a miss into what it should be. There should be something that says this is what it's about to enlighten people, because people are dumb a little bit, right? They don't know.
Do you think that there should be a plaque or something like that to signify?
Yes, I do. I do think there should be some kind of a thing that says this is what it's about, because people don't know. Generally speaking, people don't know about things, yeah?
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Yeah, no, it's...
Could you tell us your name?
My name is Barry.
Hi. Have you noticed this crosswalk before?
I did, and I watched them put it in, actually.
Oh. What do you think about it?
I don't know. I don't really have that many feelings about it. I just was really amazed that it took them so long to put it in. It must be quite expensive.
It's actually by an Aboriginal artist, and it's supposed to signify the ancient Musqueam village that this area is built on. What do you think just about the look of it?
Well, it looks okay. I guess it looks like a fancy crosswalk. It really means nothing to me.
So do you think that there's a way of improving this crosswalk or art installation?
Yeah, if they wanted to make it an art installation, they should actually put a little sign by each little button for the crosswalk so that people could appreciate the time and effort the artist did and the city spent our money to put it in.
Do you have any other thoughts about this project?
I don't know. Sometimes I think that's a little bit foolish to spend this much money on something like this that people don't appreciate when the city needs to spend it on so many other things.
us your name?
So my name's Sandy.
What do you think about this crosswalk?
So for me, just looking at the colors and the design, it's a really great representation of the Indigenous community here, and that's the first thing that I think when I do see the crosswalk. There's a lot of, like, just even in general, I live in Marple, and our community has a lot of Indigenous people living within it, and from some, just from my perspective, like, I own a lot of Indigenous pieces, and they're in my apartment, and when I look at this, that's what I think. And I think it's just a great tribute to that entire community.
Yeah, so this crosswalk was designed by an Indigenous artist, who you've heard?
I haven't heard anything about the crosswalk. Like, this is the first time I've walked past it today. Oh, okay. So actually, I've not seen it yet.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, it was designed by like a local like Indigenous artist. So like Vancouver, they called for submissions. Mm-hmm. And so this is where they unveiled it. So yeah, that's why we're interested in knowing.
Do you think that there's a lot of value in public art like this?
I think so. I think, I mean, I'm not a Canadian born. I was born in the UK, and I just feel like there's not enough in terms of culture when it comes to art and design here. I did my honours in design as well, and I just think it's great for people to have these opportunities to showcase their style and their work, because there's not enough of that here. So this is great.
What do you think will be the impact of public projects like this?
I think in general, how can I put it? There's definitely going to be, I think you need to make people more aware. Like, we all know that we have an Indigenous community here, and, you know, even just at UBC, you know, Musqueam land and everything. And I studied there as well. So it's just, but nobody really knows enough. There's not enough being done. And for that community and art in general, I think people here are quite unaware of global art and cultural art, and things like this really will give people more insight into just more diversity, I think, in regards to the visuals.
Sorry,
yeah,
thanks.
For a while there.
Oh, no, that was awesome. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. Yeah, that's the first thing I thought.
So that piece on the new crosswalk design at 70th and 68th Avenue in Marple was produced by Christina Song and reported by Christina Song and Adeline Peng. The song you heard in that piece was Slim Heart by Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks for that story, you guys. Let's follow it up with a bit of a discussion about public art. Maybe we could start out by naming our favorite work of public art in the city.
You know, the artist name is Robin Sparrow, but actually there's like a gigantic sparrow in Olympic Village. Have you guys seen it?
Yeah, I think I have.
Like, yeah. Like, it's like next to like a pub and like a bunch of fancy grocery stores. So in a really nice part of town. And I think it's really interesting because it's just like a gigantic bird, and it's without context, which does, like, the context or, like, explainer of public art is sort of, like, mentioned in the streeter that we just did, because people are like, oh, I don't know what this work was about. I didn't know it was a work of art even. So I think, like, it's maybe confusing. But, I don't think that work is actually done by the same artist. I think her name is, like, something McFawney or something like that. But, yeah.
Do you know what that artwork is about, the giant sparrow?
I never looked into it, and just know it's there.
We should maybe look into it for next time. Yeah, I was part of a public art project work kind of peripherally, and in Westbrook Village there's one that was made out of bottle caps. That it's really interesting how it was talking about recycling and, you know, how it can, you know, encouraging people to recycle more and be more aware of the negative impact of plastic in our oceans and stuff like that.
Right. Isn't your mom an artist?
Yeah, so she was the person who made it. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So do you like support your mom a lot in her projects?
Not really. I should have supported it more. But I tried to help collect bottle caps. I think everyone in the community was in Westbrook Village, or a lot of people in Westbrook Village were helping to collect bottle caps at that time. And it was a community art project, and a lot of the people in the community, under the direction of my mother and another artist, they were, sticking those bottle caps onto the artwork as well. So it was a community project in more ways than one.
Mm-hmm. So we have a couple questions here that we were just going to ask the people in the studio here today. And what is the role of public art in reconciliation or atoning for past injustice against marginalized group? Is it merely symbolic? Do you guys have any thoughts?
I mean, my first thought on that would just be that when you consider what public art means, is that it's not just, you know, the actual art itself, but it's also about taking up space and giving voice and kind of returning space. And so when you think about marginalized voices, Indigenous voices, it's really important to make more public art by Indigenous artists because it is a way of returning space, of giving back stolen space, right?
That's a really good point. Yeah, I think, like, it's so easy to kind of erase everything by building property and streets and roads, and we never really think about what kind of thing supports it, like what is the history behind the ground that you're built upon.
Yeah, exactly. And when you add public art to a space, it kind of, you know, shows what that land is about and what that land signifies. And as you know, we have to remember that we are on unceded and stolen land, and so when we are able to place Indigenous art in the public eye on that land, it's kind of a reminder and kind of pulls us back to what it really is.
Well, keeping that in mind, do you think that it's kind of important for a public art project like this to really well advertise what its project is about and to possibly, like a lot of people have been suggesting during my street interviews, that there should be some kind of signage or plaque to explain what the pieces are about?
I think there, you know, a lot of people who are, you know, more idealistic, maybe in some sense, you would like not to have a plaque because often the art speaks for itself. And I think in some cultures as well, I know, for example, in India, a lot of artwork, people generally didn't put their name on it because you generally did not, it was not a matter of yourself who designed the art. The artwork was just an expression of, you know, the universe or something you're observing. So on the other hand, I think it's often, especially when you're trying to make it have this kind of educational value as well, to increase awareness, oftentimes people who are not deeply involved in that field will not even notice or understand. And maybe it's a good way for people who are less involved to get an entry into understanding, you know, maybe First Nations issues or, you know, other kinds of community topics.
Yeah. I mean, I think I kind of understand why some artists might be shy about, you know, just putting down an explicit explanation about what their work is about. Mm-hmm. For one, maybe it's a little bit more antagonistic and it's kind of like more confrontational, I guess, if you are somebody. I think some people, I can't imagine, like, a lot of people would be like, oh, I'm against, like, Indigenous art. But, like, I think maybe they want to kind of, like, keep their distance above, like, saying an explicitly political thing, maybe. And another thing that they might be wanting to do is that leaving it up to the interpretation and sort of the ownership of the people who live in that neighborhood. I think that's also a possible explanation. But I think there's always a trade-off. Like, the more that you give to your audience, the more that you give to the public, I think there's a little bit that you're taking away from yourself as the author and as the voice behind it. So the second question is public art a good way to spend tax money?
Yes, I think public art and community arts, the arts in general, are very are a pillar of a real community, and I think they get a bad rap in terms of being a waste of money, which just isn't true. But I think when you think of the educational value, the aesthetic value, the political value, they're, you know, worth their weight in gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't want Vancouver to become more of a tourist attraction than it already is. But I think there's, like, definitely some, like, value economically, too, to have a lot of public artworks, because that's what really makes a place attractive and attracts tourists and people who want to live here. I mean, not that we need this, obviously, but...
I think
if you were just like as a city planner who wants to raise property value, not here, not Vancouver, please not Vancouver. But if you were to aim for something like that, I think like public artwork is really good. But I think outside of like hard cash value of something like that, there's also like the cultural, like what economists called positive externalities, which is like something that's good, but it can't be paid for directly because it's like a public good and everybody can enjoy it. So like how can you sometimes you can't monetize on something like that, especially when you have like an artwork out in the open and anybody can access it. So yeah, there's like, I think if you see the Marple area, there's like a lot of shops and a lot of cars around, but what you don't see a lot of is anything that kind of, I don't even want to say decorates, I like really kind of values the public space properly.
I agree. And I think too, when you think of you know, public art as an investment, it's also a reflection of the diversity of the community, right? By investing in public art and in public artists, we're saying that our community welcomes artists as a part of it, and that they're a part of what makes up the city's like demographic. Whereas if you don't invest in public art, it's almost a signal that artists aren't welcome in the community and don't belong in the community, which would not be very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if we had to like count all the way that the public money is spent, like 2010 Olympics, I think this kind of public art is not doing anybody any harm. And I'm pretty sure that it takes very, very little part of the city's budget. There's also the way that the city kind of budgets for and collects revenue for projects such as these, because I know a lot of cities, they have a public art tax for every developer. And I think that it would be a great idea if Vancouver doesn't already have a tax implemented for this already, that they should. Because obviously we have a lot of development already. And for every development, there should be some kind of, at least some thought to public art and a space for public art as well included in a development plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. I think also when you're considering it as part of a development plan, you know, Vancouver does not lack in wall space. Like, we have tons and tons and tons of unpainted buildings. What we don't have is kind of programs that invest enough in the artists to paint those buildings, right? So I think when you consider a development plan, that's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, we're almost out of time. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're live with local news every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. So thank you for listening, and please tune in again next week.
If you missed part of our show today, you'll find it on CITR.ca. Just search Democracy Watch. Also, please subscribe to our Vancouver Politics podcast, Seeking Office. It's available on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher.
Thanks so much for listening. Have a good night.